Today, I'm joined by Paul Skinner. Paul is the author of The Purpose Upgrade and also of Collaborative Advantage. And I want to get into a deep dive into the narrative and a lot of the kind of thinking of Paul's sort of work behind the scenes, because books are one thing, but actually the author's drive to work in those directions, I think, is often a very, very fascinating story. So we're going to learn a lot from Paul as we go through this. But that isn't all that Paul does. Paul is also the founder of Marketing Kind and Agency of the Future, and has also created something called Pimp My Cause. So I think we're going to be talking, hopefully, about all of these things and Paul's journey to where he is today as we go through this conversation. So welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thank you very much, Neil. I'm really excited to be here. I had very little idea what to expect, but I saw that you had a connection to mindfulness. And of course, it's very interesting to see the interplay between mindfulness and narrative. And so the only thought that occurred to me before we spoke was somehow that the idea just emerged of the idea of looking forward to the present moment. We tend to think about looking forward to the future, of course, and the future is a story of our imagination, just as the memory is a story of our past. And I think that sometimes we can just get so much benefit from stepping out of those stories temporarily in order to, you know, root ourselves more profoundly in the present moment, make more out of it, and enjoy perhaps a level of abundance that wasn't previously visible to us as a result. So looking forward to seeing where this conversation takes us.
Absolutely. And I think the lovely thing for me about, you know, talking to somebody like you who clearly is a deep thinker, and I think, you know, if we look at it at that sort of level initially, it's, I always find it quite fascinating, because there will be little anecdotes, little moments where you think, that was so eloquently put. And I often find this with the guests I have on this podcast, is that, you know, there is often a golden moment, and sometimes it's golden moments. You know, there are lots of these little kind of moments where you think, you know, that's something I need to reflect on, or that is something that I could bring into a daily habit, or that's something the rest of my organization or my friends need. And I think that's, you know, for lots of us kind of in this, let's call it mindfulness sphere, be it professionally or personally, I think it is all about just staying awake to these opportunities. And, you know, you must have found that. I mean, because you have quite a broad, eclectic kind of area, sort of, you know, series of focuses or foci that you're kind of really, really working within at the moment. I mean, because you're writing, you're providing service, you're clearly thinking, and by the looks of your bookshelf behind you, you're clearly reading a lot as well. I mean, what kind of inspires you? What is the motivator behind this journey that you're on?
So motivation is quite an intriguing question, because it's debatable whether we have the introspective capacity to really fully understand our own motivation. And of course, there are so many questions now, not just about motivation, but also about free will and agency. And interestingly, I was talking to a general artificial intelligence researcher at the defense think tank RUSI recently, and there they've moved on from the question of can AI develop consciousness to can general artificial intelligence acquire agency, as being the thing that might be of concern from a security, and certainly of relevance from a security perspective. But in terms of purpose, I think it comes back to our opening exchange on narrative, in that I would say for all of us, purpose is, or it can be, our single most adaptive capacity as a species. As humans, you know, in the purpose upgrade, I describe us as homo propositus, purposeful man, because and we could dive into how it's our stories of purpose that really separate our process of development from the process of evolution alone. It can be our most renewable resource in enterprise. So I think, as somebody who advises organizations in how to how to grow, how to achieve a greater level of success and contribution. Purpose is the most fundamental lever to pull. And a purpose upgrade, as I describe it in the book, is something that we can think of as an always available event for any organization of any size in any sector. And I certainly think that all of this is particularly interesting to work on right now, because we are in an environment where in many ways there is, you know, greater potential than at any other, you know, previous time in our existence, but is also a deeply dangerous time where if we don't formulate the right purpose individually and collectively, you know, the threats are truly existential, and our prior purpose and everything, all the narratives that we've fallen into in our living and working could be our downfall. And so it can become very maladaptive unless we're able to renew that purpose.
So you talk there interestingly about the kind of the external factors, which I guess for a lot of us have become, you know, so you know, markedly obvious over recent years. For you in this journey of identifying purpose and kind of thinking through purpose, what was it, an external thing? Because I get a sense really from listening to you talk that this is kind of intrinsically internal for you, and kind of where did it start? When did you identify as a person that there is this thing called purpose? When did it kind of first manifest? Was it an external thing, or did it come from sort of within Paul?
So I certainly think that we crave meaning and purpose. And so I think probably where it stems from is a thirst for knowledge that could morph into a thirst for being, really. So I'm quite interested in the mindfulness side of your activity. I think in an organizational context, we have to, I mean, let's go back to the evolutionary origins of purpose, because I think that being and being outside of purpose as part of our capacity for renewal and just enjoying ourselves as an intrinsic good is incredibly important. But purpose, as we tend to think of it, I think is actually quite externally driven. It's driven by the problems that we have to solve. For example, you know, our brains evolved in the first place because we need to move with intentionality. And of course, this is common not just to humans. There are many creatures that have to move with intentionality. Funnily enough, an interesting example is the sea squid, which moves with intentionality for part of its existence until it finds a sort of place of real domestic bliss, where it, at that point it becomes of evolutionary advantage not to retain the calorically expensive brain and the possibility of finding other locations, but to jettison its brain, save the calories and enjoy where it is. But of course, while we're not necessarily better at moving with intentionality than other creatures, you know, you're not going to outsprint a jaguar unless you're much faster than me. I certainly couldn't out-navigate a migratory bird. But where we do distinguish ourselves as humans is in our capacity to tell ourselves stories of purpose that help us move beyond present circumstances altogether in pursuit of some greater or more abstract goal. And that has become, I would say, our most adaptive capacity as a species. It enables us to forge more imaginative pathways through life. And of course, that's where stories come from, because to move imaginatively through life, you need to have some kind of concept of where you are, where you've been, where you could get to, or, you know, knowledge of past, present and future, which are, of course, the three building blocks of any narrative. And this explains how, you know, we've been able to develop from generation to generation in ways that have so radically transformed human life and life on Earth over approximately, I guess, the last three human lifespans. But any adaptive capacity isn't always necessarily going to remain adaptive. And we're in a very critical juncture in our evolution today, in that, as Mike Berners-Lee put it to me, the environmentalist, throughout most of human history, there was nothing we could have done to destroy the planet. With the invention of nuclear weapons, there was maybe something we could do if we made a great mistake to destroy a lot of it. But today, we find that just continuing with life and work as usual, unless we take really quite strategic and extensive action, will, you know, diminish the ability of our shared home to sustain us, and will further exacerbate levels of inequality, fragility, and vulnerabilities that are absolutely unjustified and absolutely terrifying.
Do you think, as a species, it almost requires that tipping point? It almost requires us to get to a point of pain beyond which, you know, we can see that there's like seriously, seriously downside. It's almost like we have to get to that point before we really take this seriously, because it feels like those who are, let's use the word mindful, or just awake, or just present and conscious of this thing might happen, it's still the minority. And so is it the fact that we need these dramatic tipping points before people then start to awaken? Do you see this with your work?
It can be. So, but it isn't always necessary. So, for example, if we take World War One, that was a tipping point. But we didn't really do anything in response to World War One that was particularly effective. If we take the Second World War, then, of course, the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, we have the formation of the United Nations, the architecture of the international humanitarian system. You have in the UK and other countries the emergence of the welfare state. I think more than half of the Fortune 500 businesses were started in downturn. So, I think that in essence, purpose is about solving problems. Certainly, you know, I think we can say from a mindfulness perspective that there is value in stepping outside of purpose to simply be, and that we can then step back into purposeful activity more vigorously as a result. And arguably, that's, you know, why we sleep at night, and why nature has evolved to have cycles of the season, cycles of day and night, and so on. Because, you know, we are biological beings, so we need that capacity for renewal. And that capacity for renewal is so important when we are renewing our purpose. I mean, Hannah Arendt, the philosopher, suggested that the final advantage of democracy over totalitarianism is our capacity for renewal. And so my interest in purpose isn't just the sort of celebrating purpose as a wonderful thing. It's in really interrogating how we go about renewing our purpose in different circumstances. And I think that is... going back to your point about, do we need something bad to happen to trigger it? You know, as I say, sometimes bad things we are able to renew, and sometimes we miss the opportunity. You know, human civilizations have fallen in the past. You know, you could think of the Sumerians, who discovered that the particular agriculture they'd grown to love was causing salt buildup in the soil that eroded its fertility, and they were unable to wean themselves off that pattern of living and working that they'd grown accustomed to. The Roman Empire became subject to the social stressor of the fact that its growth depended on slave labor, which became not only, of course, wrong, but completely unwieldy and unmanageable, and so it eventually imploded as an empire. And we do often, the problems we don't respond to sort of accrue in the space, in the shadows of our current purpose. So, for example, you know, climate change and inequality, the climate emergency, its early impacts were most sort of tangible at the poles, you know, very far out of sight and out of mind. And it wasn't something that impinged on us tangibly. You know, the biggest inequalities typically occur between our out-groups and our in-groups, rather than amongst the people that we are most frequently seeing on a daily basis. So the biggest problems that emerge are often in the shadows of prior purpose. You know, purpose creates a spotlight. It's a conscious lens that helps us direct our activity, and that can be powerfully useful. But unless we are careful in a changing world, when circumstances change, that conscious lens can become an unconscious set of blinkers, you know, that blinds us to these more important realities and prevents us from taking necessary courses of action. And this is why in something like the Twin Towers, for example, there were more excess fatalities from people going too slowly as they went down the many flights of steps than from panicking and knocking each other out the way. Similarly, regularly on a Friday night in a bar in New York, if you listen to the fire chiefs, the most common response when there is an order to evacuate a bar in a burning building is that unless there is smoke in the room, you know, people are saying, yeah, happy to leave, but can I just finish my drink first? Same with organizations. We, even very successful organizations, can end up being surprisingly fragile in the face of the psychological effects of their sunk costs, the plan continuation biases of their leaders, and the progress traps through which the very actions and purpose that gave rise to today's success can be the thing that causes tomorrow's failure, because it brings with it a momentum in the spotlight, and, you know, danger accrues in the shadows of what that particular purpose is causing us to overlook. And so hence the need for renewal, and, you know, and hence why I flashed on your background with mindfulness, because stepping out of purpose to just be on a regular basis can paradoxically help us rediscover our narratives of purpose, become more alive to them, and better be able to adapt them in the light of unforeseen events, changing circumstances, what economists call exogenous variables, and so on.
Mm. I love the phrase that you use there, that whole thing of progress traps. I just feel that there's so many people, you know, almost... And I had, when you said it, I had just this little vision of kind of skipping across, you know, maybe quite a shallow river or a stream on these little kind of stepping stones. You know, you can imagine that sort of Lord of the Rings kind of thing as you're skipping across these stones. And yet each one of those is a potential for slipping. Mm. And it's just really interesting if you think about, these are potential traps to progress if you get it wrong. And each one of these little steps, if you just, you know, wholeheartedly, guns blazing, just forge forward without stopping and doing as you described there, you know, these moments of reflection. Well, one, you could have set the sat nav in the wrong direction. You could be pointing completely at odds with where the world is going and the way you could potentially be going, but also then it doesn't give you the opportunity to have those reflective moments, which, from what you're saying, then are really, really important, because this is and I'm finding this as well with everybody I talk to, this purpose thing is not a fixed thing in stone. It's not kind of carved in the rocks and that's how it's always going to be. It feels a very, very evolutionary thing. It's almost a necessity that it ebbs and flows, that, you know, we take other directions, we listen, we reflect, we maybe work to a contingency, or we change something. I mean, do you find that this is a very, very fluid thing? It isn't something that you can almost strategize too much about, because you just got to get on and do it, haven't you?
Yeah, well, certainly I think that one thing we have to bear in mind is that a lot of today's problems come from the purpose that we've inherited that wasn't necessarily intrinsically wrong at the start of the process. I've actually grateful to John Elkington, who I'm running an event with tomorrow. He was the person who conceived of the triple bottom line, is sort of the godfather of the sustainability movement. And he cites the example of Thomas Midgley, who invented leaded petrol, which was fantastic for fuel efficiency at the time. So it was an important breakthrough. But then, of course, you know, the problems with leaded petrol, it was, you know, deeply toxic and destructive of nervous systems. He also, it so happens, invented chlorofluorocarbons, which were added safety at the time. But of course, ended up destroying, creating the hole in the ozone. And so was one of the most dangerous things that any scientist had ever done. And then apparently he, after contracting polio, invented an automated bed that helped him to stand up. And he ended up getting accidentally strangled by it. Often today's problems emerge from a purpose that actually was quite laudable at the time. I mean, even things like shareholder value maximization, you know, people always would expect me to be wildly against it. And of course, I think it is deeply problematic today as a concept. But we have to recognize that, you know, when the idea emerged, it was a moment of globalization when the owners of businesses were becoming more separated than ever before from people running businesses. And so a mechanism was thought useful to align the interests of those two groups, which was, you know, a perfectly laudable sentiment. I mean, we could come back to how that has become so deeply destructive since then. But yes, and I think in business, this means we need to rethink how we think about purpose, because too often the renewability of purpose is overlooked. And I think this stems from sort of the redemption narrative in the West, which shapes so many of our stories. You know, problem is A, if only we do solution B, then C, we get to live happily ever after. But of course, happily ever after doesn't come. You know, the story that adults tell to children is false. But the story that certainly from my own childhood, I remember children more frequently writing in the stories they would read to adults is often end with, and I woke up and it was all a dream. And actually, that's probably more insightful than the version of stories told the other way around. So borrowing from the redemption narrative, we think of purpose as our North Star. And of course, that has intuitive merit in that a North Star gives you a direction of travel, but it's a fixed object. Whereas in the human world, the problems around us are always changing. You know, I have been very inspired by President Zelensky's leadership, for example, and something he said early on in the invasion was that Ukraine didn't seek greatness, but Ukraine has become great. It certainly resonates with, I happen to have worked quite a lot with leaders in the field of disasters and emergencies. And when communities are hit by a crisis, a complex emergency, a natural disaster, they then have to reprioritize completely around this impinging problem. And oftentimes that leads to a tremendous purposefulness and a tremendous sense of collective purpose. And, you know, we talked about the aftermath of World War II earlier on. We're told also that purpose is about authenticity. And of course, you can't really pursue a purpose that is fundamentally at odds with who you are. But I believe that in an enterprise context, fruitful purpose is born as the product of the relationships between us. You know, there's no point in offering an authentic experience of gastronomic delight in an environment of food poverty, for example. We're also told that purpose is about single-mindedness. And of course, you need focus to unlock action. And that's how purpose emerges as a useful phenomena. But then you need to maintain your peripheral vision. Otherwise, you end up, you know, shooting yourself in the foot, arguably as BrewDog did, for example, when it had a tremendous performance on the environment. But, you know, the colleagues within the business were feeling that an environment was created that was, you know, hostile in some ways to their well-being, and which, you know, which BrewDog has worked to address since its staff wrote an open letter of complaint about that. So I think we do need to consider purposes, both our most adaptive capacity as humans, but also our most renewable resource in enterprise. And a lot of the models of purpose that we have are too fixed and rigid to allow for that greater possibility.
Because we love a good plan, don't we? We love a good framework or structure, because we can hang all of our activities on that. And I know I'm a very planful person. I get it. You know, flexibility brings uncertainty, brings risk, brings, you know, clarity, well, lack of clarity of communication often. So if you've got a nice solid framework with, as you describe it, a nice purpose-driven North Star, pole star that you can aim towards, everybody pulls together, wow, life's going to be great. But the reality, as you describe, of being human means that that is never going to be the case. And so there is this fluidity, isn't there, that kind of, even if you have some kind of structure, the fluidity needs to flow through it. So this is a lot about, I guess, putting this one out there, this is about kind of energy management. It's about managing the resources to focus in a certain thing, in a certain time, in a certain way. And then maybe once that task is done or completed, then kind of redirecting that energy focus. Or is it something less kind of structured than that? I mean, I'm interested to kind of find out from you, because I know you're very, very keen about collaboration. I know you've talked sort of before that this isn't, you know, purpose is not something you do in isolation. I know you're a bit of an advocate for the whole kind of collaborative thing. How does that work then when it comes to this kind of, you know, having to do it collaboratively, but without necessarily a fixed end game, a fixed end point? That's quite difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, so something that we're often told at the moment is that we're in a VUCA world, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And it was a terminology that went from academia to the military. And now I think it's very commonplace among organizations for characterizing the world around us. I'd actually quite like to nuance that, because I don't think it's just that it's volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. I think it's the case that the present moment is there to be negotiated. You know, so there's the facts of the matter, but there is something there to be negotiated. I mean, this is a conversation between the two of us, so I had no idea what I would be saying. You know, once we started speaking, you had no idea as well, and how you might respond to that. And in a sense, you know, we're told a lot about the value of storytelling in business. Often what is meant by that is stories told by a business to its customers. And of course, there are many other types of narrative in play. You know, the US economist Robert J. Shiller won the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that decade after decade, you know, the single biggest driver of economic events was the stories that we tell ourselves across society. You know, we've talked about disasters and emergencies. Even a disaster and emergency, the direct and unavoidable impacts are usually less great than the cumulative impacts of the narratives that determine how we anticipate, prepare for, respond to, define and recover from that disaster or emergency. And so, you know, the present moment and future moments are there to be negotiated with and through all of our stakeholders. And so the narratives we need to learn, you know, we need to learn not just storytelling, but story listening. You know, what are the real stories of change that our stakeholders crave? And there'll be many of those, and they'll be divergent. Story finding, you know, where is there something in those stories of desired change where today there are obstacles that we can help people to overcome? You know, story tuning, you know, where is there a jarring between our stakeholder narratives that we could help to resolve. I mean, in the case of the cancer charity Macmillan, for example, there was a point when, you know, their fundraisers wanted to make the case for how awful and difficult cancer can be. But of course, they also had their beneficiaries to think about, and they wanted to give a completely different and more empowering message to their beneficiaries that there are things you can do about it, that we're there to help you, that you know, survival rates are rising, that there are ways to be more comfortable. And so the way they squared that circle was, of course, for many years with the proposition, no one should fight cancer alone. Which was aligned the hopes and aspirations of all of their stakeholders. Storytelling, of course, because unless we make a promise of better for our stakeholders to step into, we're not making a contribution. And then story doing, which is absolutely living up to that. Now, once we recognize the plurality of these narratives, you know, we recognize that it is a false construct to think that a business simply creates a plan and then delivers on its plan. And we need to be more outward looking in our narratives. So I give one example. You know, a lot of people talk about the value of a business, you know, define their business in terms of a financial value. And I run a £100 million business, a £10 million business, a, you know, a £50 million business. Now, that's really interesting if you own the business, but for almost everybody else, usually including, you know, everyone other than the very top leadership team in the business, even, that is of no interest whatsoever. So I think we need to get better at telling stories of purpose that really bring all of our stakeholders with us. And one example, of course, in very similar to that is the Eden Project. You know, Sir Tim Smith kindly endorsed my book, The Purpose Upgrade. And at the Eden Project, they carefully track and monitor the value of all of the tourism that the Eden Project brings to Cornwall, which is now, I think, over £2.2 billion. And that is a really powerful way to mobilise support across the region.
So the talking of, I love this idea of kind of the narrative and the storytelling at so many different levels. And I was trying to picture whilst you were describing that, maybe small to medium sized business who, you know, has at its core, you know, good intentions and is starting to kind of build a route forward, but they might be struggling a little bit to kind of really understand the practicality of doing what they need to do. It feels like just having those conversations, just telling the stories is a good starting point. Does it have to be any more complex than that? Because this just feels like just natural communication with good intent. Is that really what we're saying here?
I think that's absolutely right. And of course, we must always remember to begin with story listening. But I think that actually quite a lot of the value of purpose is found in the better story of better that it gives us to tell our stakeholders. You know, it makes a business more interesting. I mean, let's go with the individual and then to a sort of SME, since you've cited that. So from an individual perspective, you know, if I asked you if you'd rather have a good life or a good life story, the average person is going to say a good life. But what behavioral science tells us is that given the option, we will choose the good life story. You know, some of the research that shows this evaluates things like peak end effect. We tend to think a life is happier if it comes good at the end, even though over the duration of that life, that may have very little relevance to the average life happiness experienced. You know, we also there's also a concept of duration neglect, where, for example, we tend to think somebody was happier if they lived for 60 years, which were very happy, rather than 60 years that were very happy, followed by 5 years that are just happy. So for all sorts of reasons, we do, it turns out, gravitate towards a good life story over a good life. And I think the evolutionary reason for that is that a good life is a happy outcome, but a good life story is a coping mechanism that helps us better engage the people around us. And we know that we can't survive on our own, so we need the people around us. It helps us develop the resilience to overcome problems that may come our way. And we need resilience to overcome problems because problems will come our way, and so on. So a good life story is a valuable adaptive capacity, one of the most important things for our mental health, for our well-being, for our social engagement, for a fruitful life. Similarly in business, of course, if you have a better story to tell that better engages everyone, that is a tremendous driver of the success of a business. And the purpose upgrade actually opens with a sort of cameo of Dr. Mick Jackson, who founded something called Wild Hearts, who was on an expedition. He was ascending base camp of K2. A young French boy was found dead in a tent ahead of his expedition. A helicopter came and airlifted the body from the mountain. But subsequently, his own Kashmiri guide collapsed, and no helicopter was forthcoming, which Mick supposed was because in some ways a dead Westerner was deemed more valuable than a living Kashmiri. The tribesman was actually ready to accept death. He sort of folded his arms and was ready to resign. But Mick was not, and got together with the rest of the expedition to, you know, physically climb him down from the mountain over 4 days. And subsequently, he came to the conclusion that he really wanted business to be about empowering people, so that, you know, business was there to help people escape from poverty, not the reverse, which is, of course, what, you know, currently, business is leading to greater and greater inequalities. And so he founded Wild Hearts, and he deliberately sought out boring business sectors. You know, he went into office stationery, and his rationale was that, you know, you don't hear much about that in the Harvard Business Review or Fast Company magazine. And that actually, if he could say that, by buying Wild Hearts office stationery, you could fund microfinance programs to lift some of the people most affected by poverty out of the world, out of that poverty into life-changed circumstances, you know, that would be a powerful thing. And, you know, he's able to tell his, you know, staff, you know, even a bad day at the office saves lives. His, you know, people have never heard a sales pitch in procurement like the one that Mick can give them. It's certainly the case that one of the most valuable dimensions of purpose to a business is that, you know, it can elevate the narratives through which we engage our stakeholders to foster a much greater shared ambition and to line up with us all on the same side so that we can achieve so much more.
So the way you're describing this and this collaborative approach, collaborative advantage, to quote a specific book, is kind of, it is about that sharing then. It is about the sharing of the vision, the sharing of the intention, the sharing of the story listening, storytelling. I'm going to use that phrase now, story listening. I love that, because that is obviously, you know, an active part of this process. What happens then if, I mean, let's say you're in a community or you're in a network or you're in a business where, and not necessarily a positive ego or egos comes into play, because again, if we're human, some individuals are maybe more sort of ego-centric, if we use that phrase or that word, than others, and see potential gains for self. So they see gains for themselves, either commercially, financially, career-wise, socially. What's going to happen then? Because this feels like it's a very caring, sharing, you know, loving, giving, good intention place. But let's face it, not everybody is of that mindset. And a lot of people, you could say some of the narcissists in this world, are very much about, but what's in it for me? How do you, I mean, I know I might be putting you a bit on the spot here with how would you cope with that sort of a scenario? But I guess this is, you know, evident in a number of different sectors and businesses. It's quite a hard thing commercially to work with, isn't it? That kind of egocentric nature that undoubtedly will come into this.
I think it's also what kind of narratives get rewarded. So, you know, since Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, you know, according to classical economic thinking, if you seek selfish benefit first, you're meant to end up with a collective good as the happy byproduct. Now, the challenge is that, you know, I mean, so somebody, I heard somebody recently quip that the invisible hand might be invisible because it's not really there. And of course, if capitalism as currently practiced were an algorithm, that algorithm would have a serious glitch, because it is causing, you know, the climate emergency, the collapse of nature's most important systems, and devastating levels of inequality, as well as many other hidden fragilities and vulnerabilities, as we're particularly experiencing at the present moment with the jeopardy that we're all exposed to, and that, you know, vast numbers of people around the world have been exposed to for some time now. The good news is that both reason and evidence suggest that if we flip that on its head and seek to contribute first, you know, we can then derive our own self-directed reward as our share of the greater overall, not wealth of nations, but wealth of change that comes about from that approach. So it is about, you know, cultivating a different mindset and rewarding a different mindset. And so I think that's how we build the cultural dimension of this, which is also important. I mean, you need leadership and focus to direct activity, to achieve a level of efficiency, to achieve coordination. But we also need the sort of softer dimensions of culture, which are about cultivating relationships and fostering a peripheral vision, because that's where longer term effectiveness arises from. And so I think, you know, that cultural dimension and what kind of attitudes and behaviors do we repeatedly reward is really important. If we repeatedly reward the self-directed actions, then we'll get more of them. If we repeatedly reward a greater degree of thoughtfulness and responding to need rather than ego, then we'll get more of that.
I love that angle. This isn't an angle that's really, I don't think, come up in any of the conversations, and certainly any of the podcast episodes that I've done recently. This whole idea of, you know, reward-driven purpose is a really interesting concept, actually, because I think a lot of us kind of feel, when we're sort of thinking about this, as though it has to come from, you know, a good heart, it has to come from being aware, it has to come from, as you said earlier, you know, listening and contributing and collaborating with stakeholders and, you know, all those wonderful things which clearly have to happen. But the reward at the far end is such a key driver here, isn't it? And it can come in so many ways that are, I guess, very personal to an individual, but also personal to the organization, because some organizations might just want that feel-good factor. So they might, as a team, just think, you know, we've given to the community around us, we've done our job, we've done our thing, we can sleep easy at night. And to others, it might be, you know, the Patagonias of this world, where, you know, everything has to be reinvested for planet, it's not about the money anymore at all. To others, that, you know, it is about the money and it's about donations and philanthropy. And you can shape this purpose upgrade to being something that is very, very personal. It's almost the personal purpose upgrade, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the reason why stories of purpose that elevate how a business engages with its stakeholders is so valuable is because those stories of, you know, back to the concept of life, a good life story, in some ways being more useful to us than a good life outcome, because a good life story helps us adapt to and better address our emergent circumstances. There's an interesting case study in the book, actually. The book has many recent case studies, but one that is not quite so recent is the Prussian War of Liberation against Napoleon. And the reason that made it into the book is that the genius move on behalf of the Prussian royal family was that when they asked the aristocrats to fund an uprising against Napoleon, they asked them to send in their gold and silver jewellery. And the masterstroke was to send back replicas of that jewellery made of iron with patriotic inscriptions on it. And so, of course, from that moment on, it became very difficult to impress anybody with your gold or silver jewellery. Whereas if you were wearing your symbols that you had contributed to freeing the nation from Napoleon, then that had real social engagement value. A lot of very big successful businesses have got a fragility to deal with today, which is that the business is based on a false construct. You know, if you as a business are probably making the world a worse place rather than a better place, if you as a business are actually ignoring rather than solving the most pressing problems that we face, then there is a false construct. There is a narrative that is going to be, you know, eating away at the creativity, the commitment, even the welfare of colleagues and other stakeholders. And as soon as better stories come to light, you know, the exodus, the migration, you know, the writing for that is on the wall. And so I think that, you know, all businesses really either need to be confident in how they're telling a story of an improved world through their activity, or become so very quickly.
And I guess trade in a new currency, not a financial currency here, but just be trading with something different. And I guess, you know, for the obvious, and I love that case study, by the way, that was really fascinating. And then from as a marketer, you know, there's so many different angles that can, you know, sort of really pique your interest for. So I'm sure a lot of people interested listening to this will be interested in that one. But I think it seems to me then from what you're saying is that there's a collaborative piece here, that the narrative is so, so critical, but the reward structures need to kind of align with those. And then ultimately it is about this different currency. We should be talking about different things and feeling that different things are the reason that we come together as a group of people on a Monday morning to do what we used to call business. Actually now it's to do good. And that the purpose here is to, yes, we need to probably make a little bit of cash in the old form of currency because we've got to be able to pay for the bills and this, that, and the other. But at the same time, there's something else going on that we need to really take seriously. And so would you advocate then, because this is very timely, here we are in the middle of January, a lot of organizations planning for the year ahead. I'm guessing by the sounds of it, you would be really, really almost pleading with them to give this space at the planning table, to have these stories being told as part of the planning meeting for this year, because as you've said, otherwise you are standing a chance of being really fragile going forward, because you're not going to be talking the language that your stakeholders or customers want. You're not going to be providing service. Okay, you might say, well, we deliver products, but product stroke service in a way that is relevant for this current world going forward, and you become both obsolete and then at absolute worst, you start doing greenwashing because you start to pretend that you're doing good when actually you've completely missed the mark. Is that kind of the right sort of balance here for these kind of planning meetings?
Well, so we're definitely in a more crisis-prone environment. And so what that means for planning is that the factors that impinge most greatly on our success may often be what economists call exogenous variables, or that I would call things that we're not expecting, or that from a narrative perspective are things that come from outside our prior story. It was interesting, actually. I remember hearing Helen Lewis telling about how she, when she taught a creative writing class, and she said that she always taught her students to write their bad guys, not as if they know that they're bad guys, but as if they believe they are the heroes of a different story. And so I think, you know, in today's environment, you know, when Tony Blair was prime minister, I remember him saying that the essential characteristic of the modern world was its interconnectedness. And I think that today, in a sense, the essential characteristic of our contemporary world has now become its interdependence. And so this means that, you know, the factors that impinge on our success are so much the unanticipated factors. I mean, whether it's a child who was studying for their exams and actually the biggest factor determining their success was how resilient they were in terms of studying remotely online, you know, with the lockdowns and the pandemic, completely unexpected. I think in that environment, you know, first of all, we have to take our problems seriously. And second of all, you know, we have to recognize that the biggest opportunities available to us probably won't be through business as usual, but will be, you know, how do we repurpose our activities to better meet the changing needs of our stakeholders? I heard Richard Walker from Iceland saying that, you know, Iceland isn't seeking to make a profit this year. It's seeking to remain a useful part of its customers' lives in the hope of benefiting from that as a business in future years with the cost of living crisis, or that we could rebrand the cost of inequality crisis, of course. So I would say that, you know, in environments of change, we learn to innovate incrementally, then disruptively. With the arrival of the internet and digital communications technology, we learn not just to innovate, but to transform our organizations and how they operate. And I think we've now reached a level where our opportunities are so interconnected and our risks and threats are so interdependent that we need to get better at a level of change that reaches right down into, you know, our definition of success and what we are trying to achieve in the first place. You know, we've seen businesses repurpose supply chains during the pandemic. We've seen treasuries, you know, reverse their centuries-old tradition of collecting money to instead distributing it. You know, with the invasion of Ukraine, you've seen Germany abandon its policy of demilitarization. Sweden, Finland abandon their neutrality. You know, and that's not even to mention what the people of Ukraine are having to go through. I think that fundamentally repurposing our activities is increasingly the biggest opportunity available to us.
So the purpose upgrade defined here by Paul as being just wake up and seize the opportunity right here, right now. Because this is the moment, isn't it? If we think in timeliness, it feels like we've been building and building and building as a scale of an opportunity to this moment. This just feels like almost the perfect storm now, doesn't it? Where it's almost like we're beyond the point of kind of no return. There's a have to as part of this equation now. But also there's a big opportunity in a positive way, redefining the success, collaboration, stakeholder engagement, all the right kind of things that the textbooks of old would have said we should be doing. But actually now there's a real reason to embrace this, isn't there?
Yeah, wonderfully. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Great. So the purpose upgrade, where and how can people buy the book? How can people engage with Paul? How do you want people to contact you if they're looking to carry this narrative forward?
Yeah, so I'd love people to pick up the book. I mean, they can read more about it at purposeupgrade.com. You can buy it Amazon, Waterstones, any good bookshop, probably any mediocre bookshop too. And there is an audiobook version for people who prefer to listen, that you can pick up for a credit on Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks. People can connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like me to support your own organizational purpose, and you can find me at the Agency of the Future, www.agencyofthefuture.com. theaof.com. I've also learned a huge amount. If we could take a moment, just I'd love to introduce Marketing Kind because it might be so relevant to your listeners. But Marketing Kind is a membership community for marketers who, you know, believe in the power of marketing, believe in the power of narrative to really change the world. You know, we believe that as the world's most important problems depend more than money and more than on technology, depend on human cooperation for their resolution, that makes them marketing briefs in disguise. And so there's a community that you can find at marketingkind.org, a membership community where we really take action on this agenda. So first of all, every month we upcycle our marketing skills in support of a different charity or social enterprise. Secondly, we coach and support each other in becoming more conscious, impactful leaders, change makers and marketers through our digital firesides, through our Your Marketing Kind gatherings. And then finally, we really do dig into some of the bigger stories that we live and work by and how we might change those stories for the better through our exchange activities. And there we've worked with many of our heroes, you know, in the marketing world, with Seth Godin on how we can make all marketing for good. We've worked on Path to Climate Compatible Living with people like Mike Berners-Lee. We've worked with Ian Goldin, who ran the State Bank for President Mandela, who was Vice President of the World Bank, who's worked through with us how narratives can rescue humankind. And so every month we are, you know, working with some of our real heroes to explore how we can change some of these bigger stories so that we can all become a part of something more purposeful and that we can really believe in.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'll put all the links, everybody, to each of these networks and obviously the book and everything else regarding Paul in the description that you will find below. Paul, thank you so much for your time today. It's been absolutely fascinating listening to the anecdotes, the stories and the ideas. I've got so much I need to go away now and think about and kind of maybe repurpose and reshape some of the ways that I've been describing things. Mm. And I would certainly encourage everybody to get a copy of The Purpose Upgrade. Absolutely fascinating read. And you will come out of this with more ideas and opportunities than you ever thought possible. So thank you again, Paul, for your time.
Thank you, Neil.